You're listening to KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. Next up, Truth Quest with Melody.
Gonna tell you a story not long ago, high on a mountain in Idaho. I was living free, so sold off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. Down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. Down. My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys, don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
That was Ruby Ridge with my co-host playing on his Bluegrass Conspiracy album, and that's my co-host Eric Carlstrom. And tonight on Truth Quest with Melody, we have a real popular guest. I can tell they've loaded up the streaming tonight, and this is Alan Watt. And this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I do the disclaimer that the, they keep moving it around here. Well, I'll read it when I see it again. Okay, and so ultimately, my guest tonight is Alan Watt, who's a long-term researcher into the causative forces behind major changes in historical development. His background is that of a Renaissance man with a background in three professions, plus having various books published in religions, philosophy, poetry, mainly under pseudonyms. For much of his life, for main income, he is heavily involved in the music industry as a singer, songwriter, performer, involved in folk music, blues, pop, rock, and even classical. Also known for his session guitar work, he has played with some of the most well-known artists and groups. Born in Scotland, he watched the subtleties of politics and media as they guided the population of the UK covertly into a European amalgamation. He has been warning the North American people for some years now that the same process of amalgamation has been carried out. With historical documentation, he shows how cultures are created and altered by those in control, always to lead the people like sheep into the next pasture. Learn the true esoteric meanings of mystery religions from one who knows. Learn the science of religion, creation, domination in the latest book trilogy, Cutting Through Volumes 1, 2, and 3, attempts to deprogram the reader from his or her indoctrination from accepting the world as presented. These books help stimulate the individual's mind into higher, truer perception. These are 12-hour MP3s in history, religions, from ancient times to present, to augment the books. And this is Alan's current items are for sale on cuttingthroughthematrix.com and alansentinel.eu. Are you there, Alan?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. And Eric?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yep. Great. Well, I'm going
to
let you...
Welcome, Alan. It's nice to have you back on the show. We had a very interesting interview several months back, so I'm looking forward to the follow-up.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on again.
And Alan is coming from north. He is talking from northern Ontario. Again, for our listeners, he has a website called cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And Alan, if I could kind of direct the beginning here, I know you're a musician. I also am a musician, and I've written songs over the years. I play guitar, banjo, and piano, and I write and sing as well. You have a quote in one of your articles called "Sentience in the Balance: Treasure or Trash, Your Choice," where you say music was such a powerful tool that Plato wanted it to be licensed, that it has a powerful effect on people. And if you can indulge listening to a song that it took me a long time to write, I was hoping we could listen to this song. It's called Ode to Jimmy, who is one of my boyhood friends. It's told in the song. But he died of a heroin overdose in 1969 at the age of 20. Mm-hmm. And this song is my attempt to understand what happened to my childhood friend, who was really, really quite a bright guy. And if we could listen to that and then talk about how music is used as a way of controlling and influencing and manipulating people, I think that would be very interesting for our listeners.
Yeah.
Jimmy was a tall and a skinny, funny-looking kid. He and I was best friends in the second grade. We was always cutting up and giving our favorite teacher fits. But he was in that purple reader all the way. By the time that we grew up to high school age, he'd read most of Steinbeck and was writing poetry. He was playing on the football team, picking folk songs with Ames and Dave and me. Then one summer day, my family moved out west. I had to say goodbye to all my childhood friends. But a few years later, I set out to hitchhike in from Flagstaff back to Arlington. There I found Jimmy looking all pale and weak and drawn. He was singing lead now in a rock and roll band. And I watched him stick a needle in his arm, like his hero, that other Jimmy, was doing then. Then I spent a few days at my favorite aunt and uncle's house, revisiting my second family. Seemed they were all healthy and busy and living well. He was high up in the CIA. A little bit later I heard that Jimmy died, OD'd on the bathroom floor. The word was that he'd really tried to clean up his life and straighten out once more. Thank you. Well, those crazy times never made much sense to me. The war, the drugs, and all the casualties. It's only looking back now that finally I begin to see things were not at all the way that they appeared to be. It was war for drugs and drugs for war. It was all big profits for those Wall Street banks. And it was CIA agents stealing heroin to our soldiers in Vietnam. It was stuffing white powder from Laos into body bags. They could hide 50 pounds inside each man. That's how they ship the stuff back to America. How it ended up in Jimmy's veins. Now I wonder if the ones who shipped those drugs ever had to spend a day in jail. Or if those Wall Street drug lords ever lost a night of sleep or missed a meal. But it seems the justice system here is broken now, and it's the criminals that rule. But I reckon they'll still have to face a higher law and a judge that can't be bought or fooled. Gazing now into these mysteries, how our lives are wagered, sold, and spent. But as these years go drifting by, I sometimes miss my childhood friend. Well, Jimmy was a tall and a skinny, funny-looking kid. He and I was best friends in the second grade. We was always cutting up and giving our teacher fits. But he was in that purple reader all the way.
Yes, I could, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. The story might be a little bit familiar to you. I don't know when you started to learn about the bigger picture that was affecting the culture around you, but do you have any comments about that whole issue?
Yeah, I mean, I caught on very quickly to what was going on. Even before I was 12, I knew suddenly everything changed. Britain got all its culture dictated from the top, as Plato said a long, long time ago, thousands of years ago. He says that culture is always given out by those in authority and given down to the people below. They don't allow grassroots culture to come up in case it upsets their control over the public, so they authorize it from the top. And in Britain, we only had one television station for the whole of Britain at one time. That was the BBC, owned by the government. And like an explosion, the pop industry, followed by the rock industry, just blasted out from the top, again authorized. And I wondered why those in control were going to such incredible lengths to give us this new type, not just of music, but it was everything that came with the music. It was a whole new lifestyle. It was free love, as they called it, promiscuity. They brought the pill out to match it at the same time so that they wouldn't have the same problems they had when they tried it the first time, and that was in the Roaring Twenties. They tried exactly the same thing back then, you know, and there was too much fallout from unwanted pregnancies, and they didn't have the antibiotic to treat all the venereal diseases, so they went back to the drawing board and came out with the 60s. And
can you be more specific?
Well, you see, we've never had what we think in the Western world a democracy or even a democratic input into anything. We're given the illusion that we do because we have non-governmental organizations that seem to speak for the people, organized groups. Some of them will even say they're non-political, but that's not true at all. they're funded by the big foundations, which are a front. They're heavily funded by the big foundations, which are nothing but a front for what we call in Britain the establishment, the very old families that actually run Britain and have since the days of the Norman invasion. Very old families, very wealthy, and they're above all parliamentary laws, and politicians obey them. But it's not just that. You see, culture itself is an ancient art, the art of controlling culture and creating and managing culture, because that's how you manage the public. And as I say, in the 60s, when all of this blew out suddenly, and they brought rock stars on, or pop stars on at that time, for interviews on the BBC, and these guys were falling off their seats, they were completely stoned. And it was treated like, isn't this fun, isn't this a giggle? And they'd titter and giggle about it, as though this was really naughty. So it was obviously designed to get to the youth. The whole scene was to get to the youth. And, of course, very few people understood what was really going on at the time. They brought the hippie era out at the same time. And once I got into the music industry itself, I caught on very quickly that the whole system was completely managed in a sort of pyramid structure. If you were writing anything at all, it came down to the writers what was now in and what would not be allowed, what was now out. So there was a grapevine, very quick grapevine, and you knew what they wanted, what kind of music they wanted, the song lyrics they wanted, and even what was politically correct at the time and what was incorrect. They'd tell you what to push, and everybody caught on to this. And I eventually, throughout the years, I got in quickly to session work. Although I was already on stage, I would get pulled into for session work, or even writing songs for some of the big artists who were strung out on drugs, and they had contracts to fulfill because they had their labels and maybe three albums a year to put out or whatever they'd signed on for. And they were unable to do it because they were generally young guys who thought they'd hit the big time, and they lived like millionaires, although they didn't have that in the bank account because everything was sort of rented, and they were simply put in big houses and given big fancy cars, chauffeur driven, but technically they didn't own anything, and they were so strung out they didn't realize this. For a young guy to have all of this suddenly, as much booze as you want, drugs as you want, women as you want, it was like being in heaven. And so they'd be strung out when it came time to fulfill their contracts, and they'd call in people who could go in fast and write the songs, lay down the tracks even, and play it, basically do the whole darn thing. And that's how
I've got an article. Yeah, go ahead.
And that's how I saw it very quickly, and I saw some of the big guys really in a bad shape very, very quickly, very early on, with heroin and all the other drugs they were taking at the time. Some of them were locked up for a while in mental institutions because they had drug-induced schizophrenia, LSD-induced schizophrenia, and they'd keep them for a little while and bring them back quietly. They didn't want the media. In fact, the media cooperated very well in all of this, of course, because they did not want to. They wanted a whole culture to be completely different from the previous cultures, because there was an old agenda behind this, and that was the breakup of the family unit. That was number one. They also wanted a different relations between male and female, and promiscuity was the thing that had to be promoted, and have a good time, fun, don't think of tomorrow. Was being promoted, so they never talked about the fallout, and there was massive fallout all over the Western world because of the drugs that suddenly came on the market. Now, when they brought LSD into Britain, I got in quickly to the history of it. I wanted to know where this stuff came from, and I found out it was discovered back in the 1930s, and it was basically laboratories that worked for the British government that had found this out, this particular drug. And they tested it in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, on troops and soldiers in the British Army. And then they tested it on even agents with an MI5 and MI6. And Peter Wright, who was an MI6, wrote a book called Spy Catchers, and he discusses that in there. And interestingly enough, it was Victor Rothschild, who was one of the few Rothschilds who worked for the British military establishment in high-tech and bacterial viral warfare projects at Porton Down Institute in England. He was in charge of this project for testing LSD. Well, when they eventually released it on the public, again, promoting it from the top, from television, with the authority of the British government, because they owned the station, garbage bags full of LSD were being tossed over university walls out of limousines for free. And that's literally how they were getting the whole thing started. This stuff was made in laboratories, basically owned by the British government.
Okay, I've got an article here, or a chapter out of a book by Dr. John Coleman, and the chapter is called The Beatles and the Aquarian Conspiracy. And he talks about the fact that the Tavistock Institute for Human Relations was behind pushing the Beatles. And again, like you say, it was designed as a social experiment that would, as he says, would subject large population groups to brainwashing, of which they were not even aware. Yeah. He says the phenomenon of the Beatles was not a spontaneous rebellion by youth against the old social system. Instead, it was a carefully crafted plot to introduce by a conspiratorial body, which could not be identified, a highly destructive and divisive element into a large population targeted for change against its will. So, and he says even a lot of the words were not written by them. They were written by a guy named Theo Adorno. I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, Theo Adorno is quite an amazing man. You see, a lot of people, what people don't realize is that when the Russian Revolution took place, there was a schism between the Marxist, Leninist ones, and the Trotsky faction. And eventually the Trotsky faction were brought over by the British Secret Service and employed by them. So the U.S. brought a lot of them in too, and they got eventually, during World War II, they came into the OSS, and Theo Adorno was one of them. He was a professor of music and philosophies as well, well-read, well-studied, and he wanted a new system worldwide, and he was employed by the Secret Services to help bring it about. He was a friend of the Queen of England, and he owned the rights of the Beatles' music right up until he died, and I think it was in the either late 70s, early 80s he died, and the music went up for sale. Paul McCartney came over to the United States and put a bid in for the rights of the music. He wanted to buy them, and he was beat by Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson now owns them. So the Beatles never owned the songs.
Well, we were sure fooled on that one, huh?
Well, didn't McCartney end up buying up a lot of other music after finding that out?
He may have done. I know that to make up for the little fight they had with Michael Jackson, between his agents and Jackson's agents, they did a song together called Pals or something, or Friends. But I know he bought other music after that.
Yeah, I wanted to go ahead and read that disclaimer now that I found it, and I'm just saying the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHAN staff, volunteers, and board of directors. Okay.
Yeah, I've got some more words to read here from Dr. John Coleman, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Alan. He says, without massive media hype and without almost round-the-clock coverage, the hippie beatnik rock drug cult would never have gotten off the ground. It would have remained a localized oddity. Mm-hmm. And so basically he's saying that the media helped put the spotlight on the Beatles and made them who they were. They were chosen, you might say, by the Tavistock Institute to fulfill this mission. They were supposed to be the good boys that would, according to John Coleman, there were the good boys that would kind of soften up the West for use of marijuana, whereas the Rolling Stones, who was one of my friend Jimmy's heroes, were the bad boys who would model the use of harder drugs and even more satanic lyrics. Does that ring true to you?
Well, there's no doubt that the Beatles came out of nowhere and they were heavily promoted by all media all of a sudden at the same time. And whenever you see that, and you know there's coordination behind it and there's big money behind it. And in the music business, everyone is managed, heavily managed. I've seen how they make stars. I've seen them pick people out of lineups, tell them the songs they're going to sing, here's the outfit you're going to wear. They'll show them drawings of their gimmick or their pose or whatever, and after those three or four songs, they're back out again. You make a star. You in this business, you make a star, you see.
Do you want to get into what the Tavistock Institute is a little bit?
Well, it goes even further back than the Tavistock Institute. And really, when you begin with the Darwinian era, that was, again, that even Darwin was made a star, in fact. No one had heard his name before, and all the media suddenly built him up for about a year before his book was released. So everyone expected this genius to speak, and he was an instant success because people were already programmed to believe it. That's how you create a star. But his best friend was Sir Thomas Huxley of the Huxley family. Aldous Huxley, who did Brave New World, was his grandson. And Julian Huxley, who became UNESCO's leader for a united culture through education for the United Nations, was his brother. So these all go back to Thomas Huxley, who took over championing the Darwinian cause when Darwin died. And these guys were all aristocrats and members, all related to royal families in Britain. And when you look, Sir Thomas Huxley got a group of people, young students together that were specially picked. H.G. Wells was one of them, and they called it the Red Tie School. They all wore red ties for revolution. And their idea was to start writing books that would fascinate young people along what became science fiction and promoting cultural changes through their writings and the future projections. And H.G. Wells, as early as the 1880s, 1890s, was first writing books on the coming world where there'd be free love and the old bonding would be gone. You wouldn't have the bonding, it wouldn't be necessary anymore. And how this super state, this utopia, would be taking care of every individual. And he never stopped. He was a front man all along. Well, these characters eventually worked with other scientists, and they had worked on history and culture. And everything that goes into the creation of a culture in any country, they had histories of every culture that ever existed. And eventually that group blended with the Tavistock Institute, which initially was a mental hospital trying advanced scientific techniques for its day. They were using electrodes in the brain as far back as the 1940s, 1940s and 50s.
Do you know when it began?
It began at the turn of the 1900s. Tavistock was also used. The scientists that, as I said, had now blended with these cultural experts. They used Tavistock to give all the British propaganda when the BBC first came out in World War One, and they were giving out. They found out that they could influence whole nations' behaviors by modifying their behavior through fantasy and fiction dramas that were serial dramas, and you would tune in the next day at the same time because it'd always leave you with a cliffhanger where the hero was in trouble or whatever, and everybody was running home to try and hear the next episode, so your behavior was being modified already. And along with the storylines came patriotism and fight for your country, and they tried to get the recruiting level up through giving fantasy, which worked very, very well.
Did it have an American or a German counterpart?
Yes, because in Germany, the Germans, actually many of the people who now run Hollywood came from Germany, and they left the 1930s. When Hitler came in, and they ran the German movie industry was much bigger, in fact, than the American industry right up until the 1930s, 40s. And so they led the world in propaganda, and they were putting out a lot of stuff to do with communism, socialism, and so on through their movie forms, and then came over to the U.S. and continued.
And is there a specific name tied to any of the institutes or institutions that were doing these experiments? Or
there were many varied institutions and think tanks all combined together. We know, for instance, that the RAND think tank is one of the biggest ones. The RAND organization is hand in glove with the CIA and has been for many, many decades. But there's many other institutions apart from them. If you look into the British system, that's where the key is, because in the late 1800s, they were out for world empire. And it had been a long-standing goal, even as far back as John Dee in the 16th century. He coined the term the British Empire. And so in the 1800s, you had people like Cecil Rhodes, who became Lord Cecil Rhodes, who was in partnership with Rothschild, Baron Rothschild at the time, and they set up the Rhodes Foundation, and that basically was to create scholarships on one level, scholarships to train world leaders from all countries who go back to their own countries and work towards a global governmental system. And they eventually merged with the Milner Group, Lord Alfred Milner, who was heavily involved in British intelligence always. And they had the Round Table Society, still on the go today, and they merged the Milner Group with the Cecil Rhodes Foundation, and now it's called the Royal Institute of International Affairs. They run the global structure. Every British Commonwealth country has its Institute for International Affairs, and they basically dictate the global policy for the world. They drafted up, by the way, the amalgamation for the Americas and presented it to the Canadian government and the U.S. government, and they admitted that on television here under their own name for the first time. And they're also a non-governmental organization. Nobody elects them. And here they are drafting up laws and the amalgamation rules, which are being signed every year since 2005 till 2010 until it's complete. And the American branch, because they can't call it the Royal Institute for International Affairs, is called the Council on Foreign Relations.
And do we have some Americans that are Rhodes Scholars?
Oh, yeah, you're lots and lots of them. There's over 200 in your high bureaucracies in the federal government.
That are Rhodes Scholars?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so is Bill Clinton.
Isn't Chris Christopherson one, too?
Yeah, he is, although he went into the acting side of it, yeah.
Okay. And as far as the... does the MK Ultra does like the American branch of these mind control, and I mean, because that's what you're really talking about is mind control, and we have American counterparts to the Tavistock, and it seems like a lot of it was possibly coming out of the Stanford area. Is that?
Oh, definitely. Stanford was a big player in all of this. But you also had every other university involved as well. In fact, last week, if you go to my site, I've got talks there where I read on some of the experiments they did on mind control, even constructing fake prisons within universities in the United States, and depersonalizing the people, the volunteers. And it was quite a... In fact, the Germans made a movie out of it. It's called The Experiment. You can get it in America, and it's factual. It's, they followed... what happened in those experiments in the United States.
I believe I did see that. It might even be on Google Video.
Uh-huh.
And as far as, I've been on your site, and I've been going through some of your, did you call them blurbs?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, they're quite interesting talks that you get in and follow through some of the history. And
Melody, can you speak up? I can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry here. I'll try to turn it up a little bit there. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. And so I kind of like you to tie in some of the what's happened in the past that is going on in the present, and which you do very well, and kind of like you'd turn you loose on that if you'd like.
Yeah, well, in the past, in the 1800s, they knew, because Britain is famous for doing statistics and projections. They ran an empire, not in 10-year plans and 20, but 100-year plans. And they knew that eventually the Industrial Revolution would be well over. They knew that they'd have what they claimed would be an overpopulated world. And they set out through the Cecil Rhodes Foundation and other foundations they set up. All these foundations are fronts for the establishment, the royalty, the ones who really run the country and all their cousins. There's thousands of them. And they thought they were talking about ways, first of all, to stop people breeding. And it was so clever, really, because you'd think that promoting promiscuity would have the opposite effect. And initially in the 20s, when they tried the same project with the Charleston dance, the miniskirt, they brought in cocaine into the booze cans and illicit booze, made it all very sexy and appealing to young, rebellious people. But they had all the fallouts of children. They didn't have abortion clinics. They didn't have the pill and so on. And so they brought it all out again. They went back to the board and worked fervently to get a good contraceptive device or pill, and make abortion legal. That way they take care of the overflow. But the idea, and this goes back to Lord Bertrand Russell, another member of the British elite, who was given charge of experimental schools, where he had a free hand to do whatever he wanted to do, very much like Skinner in the United States, and Pavlov in the Soviet Union, and they all know each other, by the way, because they traded their findings. And Bertrand Russell was trying to promote pre-pubertal sex between children in these particular schools. The idea being that the more partners that they would have before puberty, then after puberty, up to the age of 20, that there's almost the chance of bonding with a particular person was almost zero. And so they had to promote promiscuity for that particular reason. And then once all of that was done, the state gradually, step by step, would come in and take over through departments they would create. They would take over the right to procreate, to have offspring. And interestingly enough, it's now coming out in newspapers in Britain. There's even departments, you know, of they don't call it procreation, but it basically means that, set up already in the British countries, the Commonwealth countries, and eventually you'll need permission to breed. We know that in Australia they're putting through laws to try and bring the same one child per family into Australians right now. We had a politician in Britain two or three days ago got in trouble, a conservative politician, by saying they should euthanize all the orphans in the orphanages and even sterilize single mums. That was another politician said that last week. They're going full steam ahead with this because they wanted to have a much, much smaller population in a post-industrial era. They did not need the population size anymore. And you must understand, we're talking about something that's beyond politics. The establishment don't get involved in politics. They make agendas. They give us fake politics and democracy. But they've never changed their viewpoints from, as I say, the days of the feudal system. We are ruled by them. We exist to serve them. And when there's too many of us, just like too big of a herd, they start culling us off. They bring down our numbers. And during World War II, when World War II was still raging, in 1944, King George set up an institution to study ways of bringing down the population much quicker because the war was not doing it. That same part of the agenda was eventually taken up by the British government, high levels of it, taken to the United States. And Mr. Kissinger, during Nixon's era, drafted up the bill and got Nixon to sign it and put it through, that said that the number one enemy of the state was overpopulation, and they'd have to bring it down by any and every means possible.
And who are these people that are directing this?
These people are the people who literally own the resources and the wealth of the entire planet. And they're very old families. As I say, you can trace them back through the Norman invasion. Even today, they own Europe, the whole of Europe. And they have vast lands. They even have tenant farmers. Prince Charles still has tenant farmers. They don't eat the rubbish we get fed. They eat stuff that's not tampered with. And they're very old. They're often attached to royalty and members of royalty or cousins and so on. And there's lots of them. They run the Ivy League schools in the U.S. and Cambridge and Oxford, etc., in England. These are the well-established families. But they run their government, their true governmental system, through the big foundations. When you understand how the Soviet system was run, now Soviet means rule by council or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and the Soviet system set up its own non-governmental organizations and appointed the leaders of these people who pretended to speak on behalf of the people and demand things from the government, which the government was only too happy to pass since it all arranged it together. In the Western world, they set up institutions like Rockefeller Institute and so on, the Carnegie, the Ford, and a myriad of other ones. And they fund these organizations. They set them up, in fact, and fund them and give them offices and pension plans. And all. They're not little tin can charity organizations. And when anything happens, they pretend to speak on or demand on behalf of the public that this law or that law gets passed, and the government goes ahead and does it. It's the same as the Soviet system. And we must remember that when Norman Dodds was doing the investigation for the Rees Commission into the big foundations, and there's a book called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. People should definitely read this.
When was Norman Dodds doing this?
He was doing that, I think, in the 60s.
Okay.
And it was under the Reeves Foundation. He was appointed to investigate that this power, which they realized these big supposed charitable organizations, multi-billionaire organizations were behind, because some of it just didn't make sense to them. They were certainly anti-American, anti-family, anti-everything that you'd imagine. In fact, they seemed more Soviet than anything. And when he talked to the chairman, the CEO of the Ford Foundation, he was told, he says, our function is to eventually blend seamlessly the Soviet system with the American system.
And is there evidence that's happening now?
It's happened.
It's already happened, okay.
When Mikhail Gorbachev was the president of the Soviet Union, he gave his last speech to the Politburo that was published in the Western newspapers. Now, a man who worked for the Toronto Star as a foreign correspondent, the Toronto Sun at the time, it was Eric Margolis. And people should look into the archives of the Toronto Sun. And he published the speech given by Gorbachev. And he said to them, you'll hear that communism is dead shortly. Don't believe it. He says, we're only moving into the next phase. We're expanding outwards worldwide. Now, when you go into the history of communism, lo and behold, you find out that from the very beginning, the big banks in the West, the U.S. and Britain, funded it from the start and kept it going right through its whole entire system. Russia couldn't even feed itself. Canada and the U.S. fed Russia. Most of our grain was sold to the Soviet Union right up to the end. And the government of Canada was in charge of buying the grain and selling it to the Soviets. So we created, or the West created, this by the Hegelian dialectical process, what appeared to be a vast enemy. Because out of the technique of controlling opposites, you have a synthesis. And it's really the synthesis, the bringing together of the two, is called the third way, that you wanted in the first place. That's what it was about. And they also managed to have a Cold War, which was a continuation right after World War II. Suddenly, Uncle Joe because Uncle Joe Stalin was called Uncle Joe all during World War II by the same media, was called the Big Bad Bear. We needed an enemy. And, of course, throughout the whole Cold War, our lifestyles changed. We were taxed to the hilt, and really the money was going on both sides to high-tech equipment, which we used around this period to monitor everybody on the planet and control everybody on the planet. That's where the money was really going. Both sides were working together at very high levels, unbeknownst to even agencies beneath them.
And this began when?
They set up when the Bolshevik Revolution took over in 1917. The first revolution in Russia was a socialist revolution in 1905, and they had the beginnings of a parliamentary system for the first time. The Bolshevik took over with a coup, an overnight coup, heavily funded again from the banks in the West. There's plenty of evidence of that.
That sounds like it was very similar to in this time frame that the Federal Reserve was set up here then.
Yes, you're right. There's no doubt everything was connected because they were going for a world governmental system, and they had to do it step by step. And you do it primarily through wars because your government cannot be totalitarian to an extent without an enemy and to protect you from an enemy. And we went through the Cold War era. Remember what Carl Quigley said, Professor Carl Quigley, and he was a man who picked students to be Rhodes Scholars, and he worked and advised presidents and so on and gave lectures to high-level diplomats who were going abroad. And Quigley said, you can get more done in 5 years of war and on a social scale, meaning social change, than 50 years of peace. He says, because that's the true function of war, to change all conflicting societies. Government expands incredibly its powers and its bureaucracies and so on during times of war. And so sure enough, during the so-called Cold War, you had the CIA emerge with tremendous powers abroad. The FBI took over incredible powers back home, snooping in everyone. The beginning of the totalitarian system was already there. And at the end of World War II, they already had agreed at high levels. In fact, before World War II started, they'd agreed to bring a war on which would make a united Europe a must-be. It would have to happen. And Winston Churchill, you should read his memoirs by his personal secretary, who's now a lord or a sir, and the book is called Fringes of Power. And in there is a little quip by Winston. He says that Winston, to the public, he said, go and fight to save your culture and preserve your country. He says, but meanwhile, at his parties at night with his own peer group, he was saying this war is the best thing that ever happened because we'll get a united Europe out of this. So everything is done by deception.
Yeah. We've had Eustace Mullins on as a guest recently, and I've been hearing the term British Israel more and more. Mm-hmm. And Mullins and many others would put a slightly different spin on the power elite and say that it might be primarily Jewish and that the Bolshevik Revolution and some of these other wars would be part of a long-term Jewish plan for world domination. Mm-hmm. How would you what's your comment on that versus the high wealthy families of Britain?
There's no doubt that even H.G. Wells, in his Outline of History, a two-volume set he wrote, laid out the list of the peoples who would be allowed to come into a new age. Long before Hitler drafted up his inferior types and superior types, H.G. Wells had already done it for the British government. But the only difference was H.G. Wells had said, amongst those who will come through are those who have proven through the Darwinian method of having the survival ability, survival of the fittest, they will be brought through. And he says we shall need the big Jewish majority with their banking system and their commercial system on our side. And it's no secret that because there was persecution going on in Russia pre-Soviet Russia against Jews, that was a fervent place to recruit from for communism. And many of them, absolutely, there's no doubt about it, the Bolshevik Revolution tended to be Jewish at the top, a Jewish structure. And they did believe, a lot of them were getting led by the rabbis at the time, that this was in line with Judaism, had nothing, Sovietism or communism had nothing, it was not detrimental to Judaism, they thought, at least in the early phases. But once again, you can find this thing was definitely directed from Britain. Remember, Britain's a master at looking at far-range projects, even like India. They had India fighting each other, all the different, there's many, many small countries within India at one time. It was Britain that had them unite eventually through conflict. But they had them fighting for 50, 60, 70 years, arming different sides and factions and having them all go at each other. And so they look at long-term projects to bring countries down and then take them over. So the British Israel Foundation was set up, again, with approval of the royalty, partly as a con, to con Christians into thinking they were the lost tribes and get them on board to a world system. They kept quoting parts in the Bible that said, well, you shall be as sand of the sea, there'll be thousands, millions of you ruling the world, and as numerous as the stars in heaven. And they kept saying, well, the Jews don't have enough numbers for that, it must be us. It was to get the Christians on board, and lots of Christians joined the British Israel Association. It's still pretty strong in some parts of the United States, but that was really promoted from the British, the high secret services of the British government. The Department of British Israel Foundation is the same office, you'll find out if you check on them. They have the same office and same office number as the World Federalist Society. It's a world federalist organization to join the world together.
What's a B'nai B'rith?
Thank you.
Is that?
The B'nai B'rith is appears to most people, and this is how its propaganda goes. It will pretend to stand up for the rights of Jews who are being persecuted. However, every office they have, and they have office blocks like towers, they're heavily funded again. They're called lodges in the phone book, if you look, because they were chartered as a Jewish wing of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. They're a Freemasonic group who use their Judaism as a front to get certain demands made that will affect the world for Freemasonry.
Which is the tail and which is the dog there, do you think, Freemasonry or Judaism?
There's different spins on it. I do know that secret societies have gone back for thousands and thousands of years. Rome had them. Every group had them. You get any group together. Even the military's got their own and always have had all militaries in all ages. And we know that Herod started up a sect to fight early Christianity and authorized it. However, Albert Pike himself, who was called the Pope of Freemasonry, said that they did not have to choose the Hebrew Bible to base their belief on. He said we could just as easily have picked Nimrod or some other great leader. So they chose the Bible simply because it was something that was familiar with the whole Western culture at that time.
I've heard... In fact, one talk show host that I've been listening to a little bit lately has been quoting some things, and maybe Jim Mars is the one who said it, that all roads lead to Samaria. And is how much of what is taking place today being influenced by that?
What's interesting is more like Babylon.
Okay.
To be honest with you, even the Rolling Stones came out with an album called Bridges to Babylon. One of their later ones, in a tour of Babylon, the Babylonian tour, that became popular because Babylon was the seat of mystery religions and a world empire in its day. It was the commercial hub of the ancient world for a long, long time. And part of the mystery of Babylon was that if you were to go there as a visitor, you would see 1,000 different priestly sects, and you'd leave never knowing that there were all different parts of the same religion. They used to call it the 1,000 faces of Isis, and because they knew that to run the world, you run it by creating many front organizations and side organizations that can confuse the onlooker. You don't realize they're all working towards the same goal, and they were even back then. Babylon ruled the ancient world financially. So it's interesting that now, what's very interesting today is that when the big corporations move out of the United States, they're moving closer to that region. They're building up Dubai into the most modern city in the planet. And Halliburton moved there, and many other companies are moving there. The French government is setting up a duplication of the Louvre in Dubai.
I've heard a lot of those buildings that they've been building there that are, you know, really quite some phenomenal buildings are empty.
Yes, they're empty because it'll be the elite who eventually will move in, because it's like, as I say, it's like a circle to them. Now, in their high religions at the top, they do claim that they have come down through the ages and moved and created one empire after another and just move out to the next one. So technically, and there's no doubt there has been a world revolution going on for many thousands of years. If you go back to ancient Egypt, and you see that Plato himself and many other ones in the aristocracy of the Greek people, they all trained in Egypt. They studied the mysteries and had their education in Egypt. And people like Pythagoras, when he left, he was sent out to part of the Greek Empire. He went to Crotona, which was in ancient Italy. And he set up his little group there. And Pythagoras himself was trying to foment revolution. He was bringing in male and female for the first time, students from aristocratic families or noble families, and even training, grooming the females to be excellent brides who would help to manipulate the policies of the kings and so on in the areas that he'd marry them off to. And eventually, when the people found out, they burned down his school, and they say he probably died with the school. But he wasn't the only one. Socrates did the same. And they'd all studied in Egypt. So whoever left Egypt came back to his own country or to wherever he was sent, and was set up a mystery school under the name of philosophy. And they would foment revolution. So Egypt was fomenting world revolution wherever it went.
Now, some would say that Nimrod is Satan, wouldn't they?
It's one of the names of Satan. See, Nimrod, if you understand the mythologies of Nimrod and his wife, Semiramis, and the child Ninus, there's always the father, mother, child. However, he himself was the same as Prometheus, was the same as Lucifer, that was cast to earth and fought the angels. And when he was cast to earth, under mythology, he built the castle, the first castle, and that was a symbol of the same people down through the eons. They built these massive fortresses all across Europe when he went to Europe, for instance. But they also did the same across the Holy Land, two massive castles. And in fact, his wife, Semiramis, eventually, her symbol is the castle.
Don't we have a symbol of her here in America?
There's many symbols. And the United States was the first openly, using the term Freemasonic, society ever shown to the world. And it's interesting, too, when you go back to the Founding Fathers and you read Benjamin Franklin and you read Jefferson, both of them said that they hoped that this would be the nucleus, the beginning of a world federation, not just a federation of states. Federation of world states.
I need to break here just a second and say KHENLP 106.9 Salida. This is Truth Quest, and also state that the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHAN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my co-host tonight is Eric Carlstrom, and my our guest tonight is Alan Watt. Okay? Go ahead, Eric. Alan?
I'm here.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's fascinating to go back, and what we're starting to see then is a long-term plan. You're talking about Babylon thousands of years ago, which would then have somehow persisted through history, but changed, I suppose, from region to region, or the center of power of this plan would have changed from region to region. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, technically, wherever Babylon went became New Babylon. It wasn't just one place, although it was a place at one time as well. It was a system. And they often, when they created a new empire, they'd always bring the lion with them. At the gates of Babylon, they always had the lions over the gates. The same in London. You'll see it on coats of arms of many royal families down through the ages. And sometimes dragons, you know, the same old symbols over and over, which have nothing to do with reptilian people. But as I say, the first religion, Nimrod, or the early religion of Nimrod, was a form of worshipping a rebel, the one who was flung from heaven and who stood up to the gods, or the Demiurgos god. See, the god of the world in ancient times, and even in esoteric today, the god of the world is Satan, or Lucifer. They're really two different entities. And it's got many allegories, like Prometheus, too, stole fire from the gods and brought it, meaning intelligence, and brought it to earth, to mankind. So in the occult traditions of ancient times, Prometheus was a savior. The same with Nimrod, a massive, powerful warrior, incredibly intelligent, but also a rebel against the supposed creator of the system, who was a bad guy, who had rules and regulations and gave you a life of misery. So it depends on whose side you take it from. When you're completely neutral and you see from what it is, you understand how the religions were formed in the first place. And when he was killed, supposedly, in this war of the gods, Nimrod died, his wife then, and this is traditional in religion, is then elevated above him, and she becomes a virgin again. And she became a virgin, the queen of heaven. And then the son was also made a god, but you always got to the son through the virgin. And this is repeated down and down and down through history, even through the Greek religions as well. You always got to the father god through the mother, as tradition. So religions were always used as a tremendously effective way of controlling, mind control of whole nations. And that's why if you read the writings of Aristotle, for instance, he goes through in some of his writings the system of government, beginning with the noble or royal families at the top, nobility, and then all the military, but also that a lot of the money had to be spent on the priesthoods because they were so effective in controlling the populace by basically giving them what seemed to be the reality.
So it was about control then, as it is?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's always been about control, always. Yeah.
So basically, the ruling elite then as now prefer a feudalistic society where you have a few of them who are somehow they consider superior to everybody else, and then you have the human herd of unwashed masses who are considered like cattle and like domestic human beings, perhaps like slaves. That would be a fair assumption.
That's how it's always really, in a sense, been. We can go into, again, the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he explained the upcoming system, the Technotronic era. And he talked about, it's called The World Between Two Ages, is the name of the book, Between Two Ages, but the chapter is called The Technotronic Era, when he says the new system will be run by those at the top, plus the technocratic class. He's talking about a technocrat, as people like himself, Brzezinski, the Kissinger types, the Maurice Strong types, the ones who have real power. And if we go into the writings of Professor Carl Quigley, who was a historian for the Council on Foreign Relations, the American branch of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, right from the horse's mouth in his own book, Tragedy and Hope, and his other fantastic book called The Anglo-American Establishment, that goes through the hidden histories of the British and American empires and their goal. Quigley himself has said the new system that's coming up that we brought in will be a new feudal system, with the CEOs of corporations, international corporations, being the new feudal overlords. So that's already happened.
I've been reading that there's a big new Brzezinski has a direct tie-in with the candidacy of Barack Obama.
It's very possible, but personally, I don't think it even matters. I think all politics, this is my opinion, is a show for the public.
Right, right.
Because I traveled so extensively across the world, and I'd see the same laws being passed in every country I'd go through about the same time. And it was always treated as though it was a national thing, and of course, you didn't know that your neighbor and country was doing the same law at the same time. And I realized there was already a world system set up.
Okay, and so, go ahead.
Yeah, Alan, would you, I read books like by Tom Hartman, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance, and The Theft of Human Rights, and he seems to make the case that democracy has happened to just a few places for a short time in human history, and he starts with Greece, and then he talks about the great experiment in America. And he says it's very fragile, and it is the exception, and that feudalism is the rule. How much of an exception would you say we have actually had or been in this great quote-unquote American experiment? Would you say it's just kind of been a variation in this old theme?
It's been a variation, but I have to say, that the United States and every major job is to be had of any import whatsoever in government or even local government. You only find they're all Freemasons. That's the religion that's always run the United States of America. And if you go into the writings of many of the big players in Freemasonry, right from their own books, like Albert Pike, you'll find that he talked about the end, the need to end property. It was a major one enemy for peace, private property. A new way of having families, in other words, male and female, different relationships. If you compare everything that Pike talked about to the Communist Manifesto, you'll find they're pretty well identical.
Well, it seems strange that they would build up the middle class and then turn around and tear it back down. But
it's perfectly in line with what they do. When they sent over settlers into the United States, and it was called the Americas, really, before the Revolution, they were at war with the French. The French were trying to hold on to it. And everyone fought against the French, there was no borders at the time. And I've got books going back to the 1700s, and it's incredible the Masonic influence that was even around at that time. But eventually, they can allow you to take over land, and you had the big drives there to settle land, and races even to who first come, first served, if you were on that plot first and drove the stake in. They knew darn well, remember, that you could make that, you'd clear all the scrub, you'd clear all the land, you'd make it into real estate, something productive economically. But they also knew that one or two or three generations down the road, they could take it back from you just as easily.
So in other words, it's kind of like they do with small businesses. They let them do the research and development and then come in when it's a successful.
Long term. So we think so short term. that's why they get away with it at the top. We think what we can do in 5, 10, or even 20 years is a stretch. These characters literally through institutions, and again, this was explained by Carl Quigley and others, when an institution is formed, is given its tenets of operation, its objective, its own manifesto, it can hire and work and retire and recruit and work and retire generations of men all working intergenerationally towards the same agenda. And that's how the British governmental system truly has always worked. The higher levels of government. It's long-term planning, long-term projects, like a chess game. You sit for a long time staring at those pieces. Everyone else is so impatient. And you know that whatever you allow people to have, you can take away tomorrow.
And
I read that the British government is extraordinarily infiltrated by Freemasonry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the British government, you have to be in Freemasonry to be in the government. And you have to be in Freemasonry to be a member of any of the special branches, MI6, MI5. Peter Wright, again, wrote about that in his own book, and he belonged to the organization. He said it was mandatory.
You were saying in one of your blurbs that struck me when you were talking about the different degrees in Masonry. And I was hoping I was understanding that correctly. It's almost like it's an intergenerational thing. So if you had two or three generations, they can kind of work higher up in the degrees. Is that okay?
Well, within again, even the ancient mysteries and right through Masonry too. Some more so in some types of sects, like the true Rosicrucians, not the ones you send off for the literature from. They will teach children to be brought up. It was specific ways of looking at the world, Masonic values. But if you're a first-generation Freemason, you can only go up to the limit that's accepted in either the York Rite or the Scottish Rite. But if you have certain qualities and good standing, meaning you have import, maybe some financing within the community, you will be introduced to a woman who has been brought up as a daughter of Eastern Star and trained. And you'll get married to her if you listen to the suggestions. And your offspring then will be brought up as Freemasons. He'll go higher, but it's really the third generation who can go much, much higher above all of the degrees that the general population know about. It's the third. So it's a eugenics program.
Well, is there a Catholic equivalent of that?
Yeah. In fact, it was banned at one time when they caught on to what it was. Initially started off as the Knights of Columbus, for instance, started off as supposedly an organization to fight Freemasonry. That's what the Pope thought it was. And when they found out it was using the same rites and all the rest of it as Freemasonry, it was banned for a while, and now it's all legal again, as far as I understand. So it's within every organization and has been for a long time. You'll find it in Hinduism, you'll find it in all other even in Buddhism. It is the
right.
Religion of the world. Yeah.
The religion of the world is what now? Freemasonry?
It manifests itself under Freemasonry.
And you were saying something about, going back just a little bit, there's a heavy British influence also in like China and the eastern areas. So do they have that kind of control over there?
Well, the Western world set up China.
Okay.
If we go into the histories of China before World War II, outside of the major cities, I mean, remember too that the Britain, the United States, France, and a few other countries had basically drugged China into submission.
With the Opium Wars?
The old queen. And they brought in thousands of bales of opium, mainly from Britain, the British system, because they already ruled Afghanistan and the Golden Triangle at that time, so there were lots of opium in India as well. And they brought that in, and they dumped it. And the whole idea, they sat back for a few years, kept doing it, waited till enough people were hooked on opium, and it was degenerating the system from within. And then they came to terms with the Queen, that if they were given special permission to have an American base, American sector, British sector, French, etc., and trade with them, they're forcing them into trade, then they would stop supplying the opium. And so they used drugs even at that stage in a warfare project. They're still using it, by the way, over in Iraq. People don't realize that American planes were dropping opium, blocks of opium, at the beginning of the Iraqi war.
But
footage of it. So these guys have always used the dirty tricks, and nothing is dirty enough to use. They'll use anything to get their way. And then after, of course, we know that, for instance, communism again was set up like the usual way it is. And so you end up with the Hegelian dialectic, two sides battle it out and then come to a compromise. And the whole purpose was to change the whole society during the conflict. That's what they do. Bertrand Russell, again, Lord Bertrand Russell, related to the royal family, very closely related, in his own memoirs said that he was sent off to China in the 1930s to teach at universities the basic principles of communism long before the revolution.
I understand that Maurice Strong's over there, China, now.
An interesting thing happened with Maurice Strong, because on a rainy Sunday afternoon a couple of years ago, I turned on my little TV with the rabbit ears. I get three stations, and one is the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. You might find this in the cbcarchives.org.ca. It was about Maurice Strong. And here's the guy in his 70s putting in 12 hours a day at the office in China. And he'd just been pulled out of Canada. They'd brought him to Canada for a while to privatize the electricity system in Ontario. And then they put him back to the World Bank, then over to China in a brand new building to work on international trade, further trade, further ties with the West. But during it, he went to a graveyard in outside Beijing. And he put flowers on a grave of his aunt. His aunt, in the gravestone, said was a great friend and advisor to Mao Zedong, the revolutionist. So these families have always been involved in worldwide revolution.
Yeah, I'd read about her, but I just recently read he had sons. I wasn't aware he even had a son. Yeah, and so he's kind of involved in the uranium?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, Maurice Strong also owned the Baca Grande ranch on top of the largest underground aquifer or water supply in the United States. Yeah.
Well, I have to let you know, Alan, that I am in a group called Water Watch Alliance, and
yeah.
I live in Crestone, which is right next to... The Baca National Wildlife Refuge, which used to be the Baca Ranch. And a Canadian corporation, Lexham Explorations Incorporated, out of Toronto, wants to drill three 14,000-foot gas test wells, oil or gas, but I think gas, right on the wetlands of the new Baca Wildlife Refuge. Now, Maurice Strong, when he owned the ranch, was the guy that severed the mineral rights from the surface rights.
Mm-hmm.
And... then he sold the ranch back in, well, while he owned the ranch, he tried to take the water, as you know, out of this aquifer, which is a huge confined aquifer with maybe 140 plus million acre feet of water. And if you were to sell it at the going rate over to the Denver area, which he wanted to do, it would be worth hundreds of billions and maybe even trillions of dollars. So now the what we're trying to fend off, if successfully the local ranchers and environmentalists did keep Maurice Strong from taking the water, but he did sever the mineral rights, and then when he sold the ranch, a local guy named Gary Boyce tried to take the water. Again, locals fought off that attempt. So the water sits there now as mostly property of the state of Colorado, but the play now is to try to get these 14,000-foot exploratory wells down there for gas, and I've been working on this, and I find it amazing that Maurice Strong is not only the guy who tried to take the water and who severed the mineral rights, he's also the guy who, when he was in the United Nations, authored Agenda 21, mm-hmm. and wearing his environmental hat, trying to basically take public land away from American people.
That's right.
This is an extraordinary man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, extraordinarily powerful.
This is the thing, you see, Professor Carl quickly explained what a technocrat was as well, as Brzezinski, and quickly said that there are those who face the public, who are the politicians, they take the heat for what happens. He says, but they take their claim, they get bowed to and all the rest of it, and their egos are pampered. He said, but those with the real power work behind the scenes, they're called technocrats. They move internationally. They have more power than any politician or elected leader. And he says they make the powerful decisions, the real decisions, unhampered by any comeback from the public, because they're not answerable to the public. And Maurice Strong is one of those guys. Yeah.
Is he kind of like a front man with the Rockefellers? Or?
Yeah, it was Rockefeller who mm-hmm. picked him up. David Rockefeller picked him up and groomed him for his position, and he's an elitist, of course, in his thinking. He believes in superior types and inferior types. His wife Hannah Strong is the same, and they truly believe that, at least he does, and his wife Hannah, that they're masters. They came back to this earth to guide humanity through many reincarnations, etc., etc. And I don't know if they still have it down at the Baca ranch there, but they had all of the different gurus and swamis and New Agers. They even had Carmelite nuns there who were very New Agey, all down at that ranch there, living there. And Maurice and his wife would go there and meditate. They even built the round tower that you walk up by degrees, styled after the one in Iraq. That was really...
It's been here, is that right?
Yeah, it's your spiral. It's your
pelter. The cigarette,
In the rock industry, the occult industry of the OTO, which most of the musicians go into, they call that helter skelter. That's the helter skelter that you go up the spiral staircase, the stairway to heaven.
Uh-huh. Well, yes. Well, since I live here, I'm quite familiar with Hannah Strong's role here. She has this nonprofit organization called the Manitou Foundation, and she has given parcels of land that were part of the original Baca Ranch to many, many, many spiritual communities. They're beautiful parcels of land. So we have over 20 different major spiritual communities here representing many religions. And so she is she's considered an honored leader. A community leader, because she has influenced the direction of our community.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, there's been a move recently to close access to trailheads that go into public land because those trailheads are on her land or land that she has deeded over to different spiritual communities. And
uh-huh.
some of us who like to hike and climb are trying to say, well, hey, we've had historical access to those public lands through these trailheads for 100 years, so why are you closing them now?
Mm-hmm.
It makes us nervous that there would be less access to public lands.
Yes.
Yeah. So all these issues are very much coming to a head right now, right here. It's a fascinating place to be, and still quite beautiful, quite spectacular.
Yes.
But I guess I digress. But yeah, Maurice Strong would be an example, as you say, of a technocrat who moves internationally and has more power than just about any politicians we could think of.
Well, they brought him back, as I say, from the United Nations to Ontario to be the CEO of the Ontario Hydro Corporation, which was really owned by the public. They built it up. We paid for everything through our taxes. That's nuclear, everything here. And he was brought in while he was still working with the United Nations. That broke out in the newspapers, and so he retained his job for $1 per year because he was getting two salaries, one from the UN and one from the Canadian public. And he started the process for privatization of everything the public had paid for to their own bodies. And now it's all privatized, and the electricity is going through the roof. And this is in the 1990s, the mid-90s. He also set up the process to bring in massive diesel generators to power the few factories left, the big institutions and so on, big buildings, for coming power outages that were going to come down the road when they started to cut back on energy supply to the public. This is before Kyoto was signed, or the talk of eventual rolling brownouts and all this kind of stuff. These guys planned way ahead, and we only see the symptoms appearing as they hit us directly. And we don't realize that everything is planned that way. Anything that happens was planned long ago.
I was very intrigued with your comment that they believe that they are masters who have, reincarnated masters, who have come back to Earth to guide kind of lesser beings. Where have you learned that? How do you know that? How do you infer that?
You'll find it from the books put out by the higher Masons. Often it's innuendo, it's allegory, and so on, but sometimes it's straightforward enough, too. And Manly P. Hall was one of them, for instance, and he wrote about the hidden masters. You'll find it with the branch they set up primarily for females, to get the females into the lodges, and that was Theosophy. That was eventually given a Masonic charter. And Theosophy, again, was okayed by the British Crown. And Madame Blavatsky talked about the hidden masters as well. And now, on one side, the hidden masters are those spirits still hovering around that haven't come back, that sort of channel to these special people. But on the other hand, too, there are ones that they claim have come back into the flesh to guide humanity to their final goal. The Rockefeller family are firm believers in this as well. And the Rockefeller family, by the way, also have been given out awards as citizens of the world for years now. I've got a video here where he's handing them out to pretty well all the mayors in New York and just about everybody else of importance. And citizen of the world comes from a saying supposedly given by Socrates when he was condemned to drink the hemlock for corrupting the youth towards revolution in ancient Greece. He said, "I'm not an Athenian. I die not as an Athenian or a member of Attica, which is Greece, but it says I die as a citizen of the world." Their goal was always to create a world empire and a world government.
Another thing that I was listening to on one of your blurbs that I found kind of interesting is how they controlled and got payment from the poor, or whatever, the regular people, for, you know, breathing, or you know, in the past, and now that they've kind of translated it somewhat into the present. Are you following what I'm saying here?
The permission for support for what?
Well, I mean, like they had smaller windows and...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and things, and now that it's kind of being molded into now being our CO2 footprint.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, again, you see, we are carbon-based life forms. And the big cry now is their big joke, you know, that you're to cut back on carbon and CO2. Well, we breathe out CO2 emissions. We are the main culprits, you see, according to them. And they will bring up, it's already happening, they're brainwashing children at kindergarten to grow up as the first generation who will truly believe everything they're told and how they must not breed. In fact, they'll volunteer to be sterilized and probably get a little... special pluses from government and so on for doing so, little favors, to save Mother Earth. And they have already stated in many different publications their ideal population number for the world in a post-industrial era, a post-technological era even. They simply don't want 90-odd percent of the public. They don't need them anymore. And you've got to understand that they're talking from an elitist, feudal point of view. They've never been democratic at the top. Never, ever.
I mean, they even speak of environmentalism back in the 1800s and that sort.
Yes.
Did they view it the same, or did they have another interpretation of that?
It's their world. That's how they see it. It's their world. It's their resources. The only humans, actually, they call themselves man. We are not really the same. They cut two species, in other words. Those who are perfected and those who are common, that's why you're called, in the empires, they're called commoners and subjects. So those who have bred into families that have proven their worth by accumulating great wealth and intellect and so on and power and held onto it for many generations are the true masters of the world, according to them. And they have always, from the earliest days, look at history, even in ancient Egypt, pharaohs would marry their sisters often because they believed they had superior genes. We have the same thing with Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin and many others were following the same policy in his era. His family only married with the Wedgwood family, the famous pottery family. And his grandfather married a Wedgwood, his father married a Wedgwood, Charles married a Wedgwood, and when his wife died, he married his mother's sister, another Wedgwood. These are breeding programs, eugenics.
Yeah. Well, you know, the I guess this chauvinistic attitude that, you know, we're better than everybody else, this also plays out, as I understand it, that the Jews have a term for non-Jews or Gentiles, which is goyim, meaning mm-hmm. human cattle, and
yep.
that they would tend to look at non-Jews as far inferior creatures.
Yeah, and the problem is even all religions will tend to do that. There's no doubt. And Judaism has been enforced again by rabbis until it's become almost a phobia in some places. There was articles in the Toronto Sun from a Jewish reporter condemning them in parts of Toronto because he heard them talking in Yiddish and their comments they were making about the Goy and so on. And so there's no doubt that most religions are racist in their very base, because every religion tells you you're special. And you even have charismatic Christians acting the same way. And then if we look at what we do when we go into other countries and conquer them, take Britain, for instance. I mean, they used to hunt, not until fairly, you know, fairly recent times, they used to hunt the Aborigines down for sport because they believed they were subhuman. So every people is guilty of the same thing if you start to believe in your propaganda that's given to you as a culture.
Yeah. I would like to think that we're all not so guilty of that, but I suppose that there can be an element within each religion which can be propagandized and convinced that they're superior.
Yeah, I mean, the British Empire heavily used Christianity and the British Israel myth that they were the lost tribes. They used that for propaganda, and that's published, admitted now. And many people went off abroad and all thinking they were fighting some good fight. Same excuse that ancient Rome used to civilize the barbarians. Well, Britain used the same thing. And, of course, as they were looting Africa and India and other countries, they were saying we're over there civilizing and bringing Christianity to the people.
So
use the term British Association, British Israel Association, British Israel Foundation, and British Israel Myth. Could you explain exactly what you mean by that?
Well, as I say, it started off with a man in the mid part of the 1800s in England, who he was schizophrenic, but he suddenly came to the conclusion that he was the true King of England, and he wrote to the monarchy. And with all this amazing stuff that he'd put together on why he was a king of England, and he was he was the first one to come out with these are the 12 tribes, we're all part of the 12 tribes. And he was locked up in an insane asylum eventually. However, the British government said they thought we could use this technique for propaganda purposes. And because they had to get the Christian societies on board with all their wars of conquest across the world for the empire. And sure enough, you always found, along with the soldiers, came the missionaries and lots of Bibles. And that was a way to pacify the public as they were taking their land over. Again, long-term projects, maybe lasting 2-3 generations. But it was an old technique. So they used British Israel, but it initially was started up by a guy who was schizophrenic.
Okay, when you say the term British Israel, then, what you mean is that the notion that the people of Britain are one of the lost tribes of Israel. Right?
One or more, and they go into this stuff to do with Dan, for instance. Dan, you see, personally, I don't think there were tribes of Israel. It's all to do with the zodiac. In fact, I've written about it in my books. Every blessing given to every tribe of Israel is actually a symbol of the zodiac. And however, in the British Israel Society, they tried to connect things together and say, well, when part of the tribes came out of Egypt, some went here, some went by sea, some went by land, and they come up with different, what they think is proofs of it, very tenuous proofs, and they'll say, well, Denmark is really Danmark, you see, the tribe of Dan, and this is how they associate things by... They don't realize not so long ago, these countries were not always called Denmark or Scotland or England, for that matter. You know.
Right. Well, would there actually be a foundation or an association that calls itself British Israel?
Oh, there is. Yeah, and it is again tied in with British royalty. It's given a charter to exist, but it's also the World Federalist Society. It's one in the same group. The two organizations are one. So its purpose is to bring a system of world government into being. That's its main thrust.
Yeah. Is Agenda 21 part of that?
Agenda 21 is just another arm of the same thing. They're looking at Agenda 21 is the agenda for the 21st century, according to the UN, which is a front organization. Again, it's a non-democratic organization. That's always talking about democracy, but it doesn't practice it because it's unelected by the citizens of the world. And they have the whole next century mapped out to do with the cultural changes, the creation of a new world culture. All your laws that you get put on your books across the world come from the UN. All your building codes come from the UN, plumbing, electricity, everything comes from the United Nations. They are already a world government, and it's been there for a while. And if you read all the books written at the time of the signing at California of the final document for the official startup of the United Nations, they tell you right there that this is the end of nationalism for any country.
And this was signed when?
It was set up to be a global governmental system.
And is that the one that was signed, was it 1947?
At 46, I think it was just after World War II.
Okay. So they've been working on this for quite a while then.
Yeah, and remember, too, the United Nations, which means one in French, UN is one. UN. And it took over from the League of Nations, L-O-N, which is a hidden lion, actually, in other languages. And the League of Nations was set up in 1917, 1918 to again be the embryo of a world government. So it simply transformed and used World War II to come to power with more power, more rights over the world. And it was like a phoenix bird transforming. But it's the same organization. In fact, when it was founded, it had all the same departments of even population management, population control, etc., etc., already established in the early 1900s.
So did they also plan the wars from that point?
They did know that they needed wars to bring them to maximum power. H.G. Wells wrote about the League of Nations, and he said at the time, now politicians are bypassed by bureaucracies because national bureaucracies and departments of bureaucracies can now travel across the water and meet with their counterparts in any country and bypass all political input. So that was the method. See, Britain runs the world through bureaucracies, not through politicians. That's the secret. And the bureaucracies always are backed by the secret services, like MI6, and vice versa. And so,
would you say Britain runs the world more than the United States and Israel, or would you say it's a team effort now?
It's a team effort, but Britain has always seemed to have been the nucleus of all of this long-term strategy, going back to, as I say, to the days of John Dee in the 1500s and Francis Bacon.
So who's going to have the ownership of the land? I think that kind of goes back to the monarchy, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. We've got to remember that even in ancient Egypt, no one technically owned anything, because it said that the pharaoh owned everything, land, sky, everything that flew in the sky, crawled on the earth and walked and burrowed into the earth. Everything was owned by the pharaoh. And it was the same with these characters who came into Britain, these Normans. Everything was owned by the king. It was a crown land. You still see crown land in Canada. It's all across the place. And in fact, even today, it's no different. They don't hang you if you're caught poaching a rabbit. However, it's still on the books. They can deport you to Australia. And also, if they catch you, they actually open the trunks of cars going through certain crown lands, and they can confiscate that vehicle and everything in it if they claim that you have a fish that you've poached illegally or whatever. You know, they have all the same feudal rights that they've always had, and you have no comeback. There's no appeal. There's no court.
I wonder. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
So the national ID and that sort of thing is kind of their way of tallying up their ownership of.
Yes, in ancient times, see, the Old Testament, to an extent, as far as I can see, and there's a lot of esoteric stuff in there, but it gives you the rules of the world system, the game, that slavery is okay. Slavery by any method, getting a person by any method, is okay. People can put themselves into slavery by owing you money, that's okay as well. And you not only own them, you own their offspring until it's paid off.
So what is the law that
they...
You
always branded your ownership on that which you owned.
So what law do they go under?
The Old Testament came out of, as I say, the very ancient world. That was, in fact, it's a compilation of other religions that already existed, which makes you wonder if it was all one religion too, again, under many guises. But it's couched often under the law of nature. In Judaism, they cannot tell you what God is. In Christianity, they'll tell you it's a loving God that carries a lamb around and all the rest of it and pats children on the head. But in Judaism, all they can tell you, and there's been a lot of, the rabbis have endless, they're allowed to dissect everything as opposed to Christianity. And they can tell you what God is not by what they see, by their senses, by their perceptions, but they can't tell you what God is. However, Judaism is an active religion where the process is to work your way towards a form of perfection of what God wanted, where in Christianity it's a passive religion because it was all done a long time ago. It was done. So they're very, very different, although modern Judaism goes by the Talmud and not by so much by the Torah. I think 90-odd% of tuition of all rabbis is from the Talmud, which did originate in Babylon, supposedly during a captivity. And they lost their priests or their Levites then. And so to keep the religion going, they created this new type of sect, the Pharisaical sect of rabbis, to try and keep it going while in captivity. And it really came out, the Talmud came out of captivity. And eventually it was added to for a few centuries thereafter by well-known or famous rabbis. So there's a lot of commentaries in there too. But in some ways, there's a lot of practicality in it. But you don't find what Christians would say is much to do with a God who really does much in your life. In Christianity, people are looking for a personal contact. In Judaism, you sort of work your way towards something which you don't understand yourself.
Okay, but basing our laws from these religions, is that... what is the ruling law now? I mean, it, with this one world UN.
The law is obviously dictatorial. We see that ourselves.
Okay.
The law, especially now with Homeland Security and terrorism everywhere, terror will be used as an excuse, and it was created for this purpose to, as an excuse to. It's a 100 years war. Remember what Rumsfeld and Cheney said. Out of this 100 years, they hope to change society so vastly that it'll have no resemblance to the present society in 100 years' time. That means all relations, all relationships, a completely different system. And through the writings of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, everybody will be a world citizen, and they will be born with a duty to serve the world state. That will be your function.
Okay, so that's not kind of a compilation of like the maritime or...
Well, maritime definitely runs the whole economic system, and all your major laws run around the maritime law, which is an economic system.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all to do with economics. H.G. Wells goes into that in quite a good detail because the economics runs everything in this particular feudal system, and everything must revolve around economics. It's like free trade, though. It's very deceptive. You have to always look at the opposites of everything you're told, because this is the ancient mystery religion. You always look at the opposites, because generally it will sound completely different. It'll give you a different perception from its real function. Free trade is not free trade. Free trade is limited trade to authorized international corporations only. A world citizen, and people you'll think, well, no borders, wonderful. No, it won't be that at all. With the chipping which is coming into place and so on, you will not be allowed to travel unless they give you permission to travel. Most people will be trapped within the present countries, although the borders technically will be down, but they won't be allowed to pass beyond borders, because electronic surveillance will pick up their chip. They have the chips in the passport, and they're all tracked by these little cell phone satellite dishes everywhere.
Well, if this is an old system...
That will transpire, Alan.
Pardon?
When do you think think it will... You've said that most people will not be able to travel outside their country.
Yeah.
I think those people who are concerned about these things would be interested if you were to guesstimate... when they want to put that into action?
Even the stuff they've published, they've talked about 2010. By 2010, the last part of the five-part treaty for the amalgamation of the Americas is to be signed by the president and the two prime ministers, Mexico and Canada. They've signed one every year since 2005, the first one openly at Waco. And... they told us on television, national television here, I have it on tape, that 2010 is the goal for a complete amalgamation.
Now, is that for North and South America, or is that just for the Northern Hemisphere?
At the moment, it's for Mexico, not to scare us all, you see, for Mexico and perhaps Chile as well. Chile has been, they've been working on Chile for 25 years, building it up to be the agribusiness center for farming. That's where your tax money has been going. Once we signed the NAFTA deal, all the taxpayers of the U.S. and Canada have paid Monsanto, Archer Daniels, Midland, that's Adam, a little covert Adam there, and a few other ones to build their big agribusiness centers for growing in Chile. So Chile is coming in, and a few other ones after that in fairly rapid succession. But they don't want to terrify us too much. All at once. Not that I don't think it really matters today. I think most folk are too far gone, to be honest with you, with their brainwashing. But 2010, we all have to have our ID cards with us at all time, as they have in some European countries like Holland. You've got to carry your ID card with an active chip in it at all times, and you're monitored in every back alley, every street, at all times, because the cell phone tower relays, which are everywhere. Will pick you up where you are, and eventually that will be a microchip under the skin. There's no doubt about it. That's coming.
So back in maybe Babylon time, would they have been talking about a one world then, or is this something that they knew was going to take place way, way far into the future?
They knew even at that time by their trading. For instance, the Phoenicians that were just the Greek word for the Canaanites, they were the world masters of trade for centuries. And they kept exploring and realized that there was a huge world out there that had not been conquered. And they knew it would take an age to make it happen, a complete age to bring it about. And so steadily, again through mystery religions, remember what a mason stands for. They take the word from stonemason, and they use their terminology of architecture in their rites and so on. But when they built the big cathedrals in Europe in the Middle Ages, massive cathedrals, it would take 7 to 10 generations of stonemasons to complete that project. And so the man who started it knew he'd never see the end of it. And that was part of the tradition. They were working towards a great work, they called it. And Freemasonry today, they call it the great work. And that is the taking over of the world and perfecting all that was left imperfect, which means that everything on the planet has to be perfected through scientific means into what they believe it should be, including us as humans.
So what are we looking forward to then as in the next few years
here? For most people, we're going to have a time of chaos. Absolutely, it's Ordo Ab Chao,
mm-hmm.
is the motto. And that's a horror show with totalitarian rule. They're already doing it in England. They had a raid with 1,100 cops going down streets in northern London just a couple of days ago. I talked about it. It was in the newspapers, at the Mail. A battalion of police now going to homes and businesses and so on. Just like the sci-fi movies they started churning out 30 years ago, getting us all ready for it psychologically. And we're looking at plagues being brought out because plagues, Brown in Britain, the Prime Minister, is prattling on about plagues going to break out. They're buying portable crematoriums to take care of it, big tractor trailers of them, you know, lots of them. They're convinced it's going to be a must-be, so I would take that as true, because pandemics is the greatest way to control through terrifying people into acceptance of a new system where your life will be ordered, and you'll be ordered to do everything and anything, and you will obey or else, because there'll be no appeals court and no one to complain to. That's what we're looking forward to, as they bring this 100 years war through. Now, the British Department of Defense, and I have on my website, had published 9 pages of a 90-page report from the Department of Defense, which is also the head of NATO, we have to remember, and they project 30 years of turmoil, chaos, mob riots, increasing and increasing and increasing for the next 30 years, and that they're going all out to prepare to meet these new challenges, as they call it. So your food supply has been taken over. They're already creating the shortage of food supply with the wheat crisis that they're manufacturing. Since only 5 agribusinesses own the farming industry of the world, it's quite easy to bring about. You only see food riots and all every other kind of riot as the economy goes down until they train us generationally for 100 years. And out at the end of that 100 years, we'll be a vastly reduced population. I doubt if many of the worker types will even be conscious anymore. I think they'll be chipped and programmed to be efficient workers, and computers will run them.
Do you think there'll be transhumanism?
Oh, there's no doubt. So they've just had the International Transhumanist Association meetings there, and every top professor across the Western world was there. They're all part of it, and they think it's wonderful.
And what is transhumanism?
Transhumanism is if the initial merging of cyborg technology, brain chips, and so on, but they're also having post-humanism, and that's a completely new type of human to be created scientifically, genetically, that will take over from even that before the 100 years is out.
So you're doing all this work. You have to have some kind of hope in this, or why would you be working so hard to get the word out?
If we cannot stir the will of people to at least challenge this and decide for the first time in their lives, would they rather be entertained literally to death literally to death? Is all this is happening? Or is life precious enough? Is there enough in life to hold on to retain ourselves as the way we are? And if people cannot make that decision, the game is over for them. All I can do is live up to my own expectations and live with some kind of integrity for myself, and never mind the way that the world goes, but I must try and give people that chance to wake up and at least say, is this life and the way I am good enough, or do I want to be some kind of cyborg, or my child to be, or a future generation that I will never know? Do I still have enough bonding in me to care what happens to them? And I have to say that I do.
Well, I think there's a number of us that do, and not without its own risks that it's beginning to get apparent.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that, you know, your time that you've given us to put this kind of information out.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alan, for joining us again.
It's been a pleasure to be on.
It's been really, really a very interesting interview. We've covered a lot of things, and I'm sure we could keep going, but I guess our time is up. So thanks so much, and hope to talk again sometime.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well.